Welcome underground. Today, we are talking about audio engineering, a rabbit hole I've been stuck down pretty firmly for the last few months as I mix my band's new album. What does an audio engineer actually do? And more interestingly, why does he need to do it? As happens so often, it all seems to come down to how the brain works. Enjoy.
Right, well, so audio production.
And well, specifically engineering, I think.
So. Okay. What's the difference between audio production and engineering?
I mean, it's quite subtle. It's certainly within like the music industry, production is making the artistic choices of which instruments play what and where and what the arrangement of the song is and all that stuff. So that's what a producer is doing in the studio. He's saying, it needs a little more blues guitar or, you know, more bass, or I think we need a flute solo in this section.
Mm.
And so that's the production, but that can get it up to something that sounds pretty finished. So what the audio engineering is doing is taking that record when it's all recorded and make it sound good,
right?
which turns out to be less straightforward than you think. 'Cause you think that, okay, get a band, put microphones in front of them, they play while you're recording,
yeah,
and then it will kind of sound like the band playing. And sadly, it doesn't. It sounds like bollocks.
Oh.
Yeah. Even with, like, good mics, you thought about the placement and you know, really tasteful arrangements and good musicians. And it just sounds terrible. It sounds like a garage band.
Why is that? So I don't want to immediately go off the deep end into realms of sort of fantasy, but why do you think that is?
Well, I mean... Yeah, there are two options. One is that when you're sort of watching a band play, your brain's actually doing a lot of work to make it hit the brain in a way.
This is what I immediately was thinking of. Yeah, I was thinking, yes, it must be because obviously the brain is basically hallucinating something using sort of the disparate, using context and signals and expectations and all kinds of things.
Yeah, exactly. And also rather like how wine tastes better when you're in good company. You know, if you're at a gig, you're excited, you're pumped.
Yeah.
And so you're also quite a sympathetic listener.
Yes.
But the other thing is that, well, what does a band sound like? What's your reference for that? And really, it's probably what do you hear on the radio or what do you hear at a gig? And okay, you say what you hear at a gig, well, that ought to sound like what a band sounds like. But if you're going to see someone in an arena, what you're hearing has been very heavily processed, but it's being processed live. And so they're not just whacking microphones up and then, you know, setting some levels and putting out through the speakers. Like, an enormous amount of pretty gnarly technology is sculpting those sounds and making them sound pleasing and making them sound like what the record sounds like, you know, or what the band sounds like when you're listening in your car. And the problem is that we've been conditioned to expect what we listen to, when we listen to a CD or a record to sound a certain way. And that way is very different to what a band sounds like in real life.
Yeah, well, like sort of acoustically, yeah. You mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back in like, you know, 50s, 60s, you'd have, you know, Frank Sinatra, if he was 50s, 60s, I don't know. But you'd have him stand up, have an orchestra behind 40s. Him. Maybe.
I don't know. I think
all these kind of...
Yeah.
All these American touchstones everyone refers to. Like, I could name maybe two Elvis Presley songs.
Yeah.
You know, apparently they're important. I don't know.
Well, it's like the Beatles, isn't it? You know, yeah. So it's Well, it's like classic. It's like the classics. It's like you know, lots of people have written stuff that's more exciting than Horace, but Horace is still more important because he did it sort of that early in the evolution. But anyway, yeah. Go. I digress. Go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We've covered this ground already.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very important historically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I actually think that they are more artistically powerful because they are so old. I would actually make that clear.
Go on. As a listener today, that makes no difference. But once you read the context that, you know, Ringo Starr, although he sounds shit now, you know, he invented how to do rock drumming.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's just, you know, we're all just playing Ringo Starr licks.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, well, it sounds like he's terrible at them. Like, he was inventing them at the time. So it's a bit like British public transport.
Yeah. Or the justification I give myself for my entire life.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
When you're on the bleeding edge.
Yeah. I'm on the bleeding edge, okay? You've got to give me some slack. Anyway, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, so when you listen to this stuff back in the day, it wouldn't have sounded like we are conditioned to expect bands to sound like today.
Yeah, and if you listen to a Frank Sinatra record that hasn't been remastered, it does sound pretty rubbish, like quite muffled and stuff like that. At the same time, like, the musicians playing had to get it right first time. So these were incredible musicians, and the arrangers had to think about what things would sound like in the room. And so you had a performance that was excellent and designed for that scenario. So that's very different to putting my band in front of in the same scenario where, well, obviously we're great, but...
shout out to Trees on Venus, that's my band.
Trees on Venus,
please look them up on SoundCloud or Spotify. I don't know, what's the one? It used to be SoundCloud.
Well, Google Play Music is the one that our singer likes to promote because he works at Google. Yeah. Normally followed by like confused silence from the crowd of six people who don't know what it is. Yeah,
I had a great joke about Google the other day. It was what's a monopoly? Google it. It was just like a little cartoon.
Nice.
So I suppose the interesting question then, or to me, what strikes me as the interesting question is how did the modern sound that we have come to expect, let's call it the sort of the modern standard. How did that come into being, and why did it come into being in the way that it has?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not an expert on the history of audio production, but I suspect that we need to talk about the Beatles again,
okay.
Because, like, you know, Frank Sinatra singing in front of an orchestra, like, you know, an orchestra is something that has evolved over centuries to sound good, and all the instruments have been picked, and you've got, you know, the quantities of instruments to create, you know, the balance. So you have, you know, a certain number of violins, which is a much bigger number than the number of trumpets. And then trumpets are also a bit further back. So they sound good when they hit the audience. So all this balance is built in because an orchestra, you know, it was never recorded when it was, you know, evolving.
Mm.
And then you have the Beatles come along, who are a four-piece, you know, guitar band. And electric guitars are kind of brand new, and they sound pretty terrible. And so you go from all this subtlety and all these centuries of expertise to, you know, 420-year-old Liverpudlians just crashing away on instruments that, you know, they're all right. They weren't great instrumentalists.
Yeah. But it was exciting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was exciting and new and good stuff that the people wanted, but the instruments weren't designed and evolved to sound great, you know, in balance together in the room, and so you have to help them. So, for example, as soon as you have a guitar, which is very quiet, and a drum kit, which is very loud, something's got to happen. So you amplify the guitars, and then, you know, all that happens. But then they occupy slightly weird frequencies, and so it's not fully clear what each instrument is doing. Like, it can sound very muddy.
Mm.
And so they were pioneers of a lot of recording techniques to try and sort this out, to make the sounds more interesting, but also to make them clearer.
That's really interesting. I never really thought of it that way. I'd never really put two and two together that, of course, an orchestra is the arrangement and the production is sort of evolved and inbuilt into the assemblage of instruments, the design of the instruments, the physical design of the instruments, the skill of the players and the craft of the conductor, I guess. All of that is doing the job that then we get computers and, you know, bearded men and in cool studios to do electronically.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah, I know for that.
And even today when you're recording an orchestra, I mean, a lot of people will be more intense now because you can be, but the Mark One thing is just have one really good microphone in the room in front of the orchestra.
Yeah.
Or maybe three. But like, you're not going to be close miking every single instrument because you don't need to.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of thinking about it. Very interesting. Mm. Okay, so why have we been conditioned to expect a particular type of sound? And maybe we could define the type of sound first. So when you are...
Yeah, I mean, obviously the easy answer, especially if you're, you know, four amateurs trying to record a record, is, well, we want it to sound like the stuff we like.
Mm.
And that's actually pretty standard when you start mixing stuff and start recording stuff. Well, you want some reference tracks so that you can kind of mirror the artistic choices being made. But that can go and go wrong. And actually, so Trees on Venus, we do have an EP out. We put it out a few years ago. We actually went to a, you know, proper studio over a few weekends to mix it. And their first question is, so we have some reference tracks, please. What do you want it to sound like? And so we said some stuff from I don't know, there's stuff I don't like.
What was said?
But I think it was like, you know, 90s guitar stuff. But I think... I wanted to sound like Limp Bizkit, and I got outvoted.
You know what? I totally agree with you on that. I think the production on Limp Bizkit songs is absolutely incredible. I mean, have you ever heard Behind Blue Eyes, the Limp Bizkit cover?
I heard that before the Who original.
Yeah, it's so.
And when
well
I heard the Who
produced.
Original, it's like, this is terrible. Yeah.
I always think of that as a reference for like what I think really good production sounds like. And also,
the guitar sound was incredible.
And
I've been trying to capture that, and it's impossible.
I'm pleased that we agree on a pretty niche. Historical.
Well, no, I mean, Limp Bizkit, like, you know, we laugh, but they are extremely good instrumentalists. I mean, did you know they started as a jazz trio?
No, I didn't know that. That's a great fact.
So they are incredibly good jazz musicians. And if you listen to, especially their earlier stuff, when you saw John Otto on drums, like, they're playing funk, just a bit louder.
Yeah.
And then you put Fred Durst on top of it.
It's a winning combo.
Yeah, but they are, and apparently they were recording their click track as well. They were just that locked in. Sound that good.
The other one, I think, the other album that I think is, I always think of when I think of really, really well produced stuff for guitar band, classic guitar band, would be Nevermind by Nirvana. And of course, Kurt Cobain famously hated it because it was so well produced. It sounded sort of corporate to him. So he, you know, had a sulk about that.
Was that the one that was Steve Albini produced?
Not sure.
I'm just going to Google this. Nevermind. Producer. Oh, Butch Vig. Yeah, because a lot of their other stuff was a lot more authentic. And
very, who very authentic.
Recorded it was an extremely authentic and notoriously so producer who died recently. But I've been looking at a lot of his stuff because he wanted the purity of the sound of the band in the room and that excitement and the excitement of a single take and, just capturing the
energy
of the band.
Energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind
and
of...
And he was good at that, yeah.
And I suppose that's more of a kind of punk sonic aesthetic, isn't it? And punk, you can kind of see... Am I right in thinking that you can kind of see punk as a sort of reaction to sort of the Beatles and all of that kind of stuff in the 60s?
As I understand, it was a reaction to prog and all that better stuff from the 70s.
Well, that's much less sad.
But I mean, we have a prog grew out of Beatles. But it was absolutely, a reaction to overproduced good musicians. Mm. even if you're just trying to record something that isn't even remotely punk, you still want to be capturing the character of the band, the personality.
Yeah.
And that is what's become very difficult now because you're doing it on a laptop. And so for our record, like, we're all recording our parts individually, so we're not playing as a band.
Mm.
So making it sound like... And playing into laptops. And so one of the guitarists doesn't even use an amp. He just plugs his guitar into the computer and...
I'm shaking my head.
You now have...
Shaking my head.
You now have...
Disapprobation.
You have, like, modelers. So something models what your guitar would sound like through certain amps. And you just put that on and it sounds like... Yeah, what that guitar would sound like through an app, except so
just listening
you could
to
never
this
record
makes,
it.
Makes me want to become a punk rocker. Just smash, smash a load of laptops.
Like. Well, the other guitarist is very much from the opposite school.
Yeah.
And so what we end up with is sort of half of the guitar parts being very clean and perfect and the other half being, like, wild and dangerous. and having the two together works well, because if everything's wild and dangerous, then it does sound terrible for all the character that's there. But if you got some wild and then some that's under control... you end up with something that sounds the best of both worlds.
I'll accept that line of reasoning, although it makes me feel very, I don't know, the sort of the notion of a band all recording in separate quiet rooms into laptops seems to me a very bleak image, I'm not trying to do you down.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? But at the same time, it is possible for us to record in our bedrooms.
Yeah.
Whilst recording the whole band in a room, that's where you start needing the sort of 100 grand budget.
Yeah.
Because it's actually really difficult.
If you kind of present it as a sort of guerrilla assault on on capitalism, maybe I can get behind that.
On the industry.
It's asymmetric warfare against the industry using modern technology. All right. I mean, I suppose we're doing this remotely, aren't we, using technology? So I'm a flagrant hypocrite.
The ones who are in the same room are better.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Or at least we think they are. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's a low base.
So that's what your reference tracks are. So one way in which this has happened is that presumably everybody has been asked for reference tracks ever since the late 70s. And through a process of, I guess you'd say, natural selection, certain tracks are used more than others, or tracks with a certain sound or characteristics are used more than others. And so you get convergence towards a sort of monoculture of sonic aesthetic.
Yeah, pretty much. And it is ultimately democratic because, well, what's successful? It's the stuff that people buy and listen to.
Mm.
And so, yeah, you end up with the sound that the most people will pay money for, which is good in some ways.
And how much does the speaker technology and the sound reproduction technology on the user end, how much influence has that had, do you think, on the way that music is engineered and produced?
Enormous.
Has it had a feedback? Has that had an influence?
Yeah. I mean, if you think of, like, you know, the really well-produced albums, I mean, that's all stuff from the 80s and 90s where it was nerds listening to it on hi-fi. And again, we go back to progressive rock. Like yeah, the stuff in the sort of late end of the analog era, it sounds incredible. And again, you had these huge budgets because you could sell CDs for £25 each.
Yeah, remember and, those days. MVC? Do you remember that shop? Is it MVC?
Yeah.
And like, something like
HMV.
That. No, yeah. HMV, yeah, there's one, but that's only just gone from Bath, for example. But there's one called, I'm sure it was called MVC. Anyway, we can Google it later, but I remember going in there and there was a sort of I remember seeing a Britney Spears CD being sold for $16.99, and this was something like 2001.
I've still got some old CDs from that era, and they've got sort of stickers on them with like prices above £20 for just a pop album.
You're like, oh my God.
So they sounded good.
Yeah. Like Micah Mechanics, you know, one. That I always think that's classic mid-90s high budget production.
Yeah. And then so we've never reclaimed that. Right. But the problem is, but again, the people buying these tracks are listening to, like, everyone, you know, a lot of people had like a decent stereo or a good hi-fi and took it seriously. Like, if you're going to listen to music and you're putting a CD in the hi-fi and you know, you're going to take it seriously.
Mm.
Whilst now it's probably going to be listened to on a phone.
Yeah, well, now there's a sort of another layer of sort of emulation, isn't there? There's another layer of digital emulation because now it's going to be listened to from a phone will be communicating wirelessly with something that is either in your ear or over the top of your ear. In most cases, right?
You haven't lived in London for a while, clearly, because a lot of people are not afraid to just have their phone on loudspeaker.
Really? Oh God!
That's how drill music is. Experienced.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean,
But yeah, exactly. And it's over Bluetooth, and then some crummy headphones.
The rest of the country. You clearly haven't been in the rest of the country for a little bit of a while. London.
Yeah.
it's very much through. Headphones or earphones or whatever. But I suppose that they use increasingly, and I think I've seen this in advert, so I don't think I'm just making this up and jumping on some sort of AI panic bandwagon, but I believe that, you know, let's say that there is processing going on actually in the hardware that's in your ear, if not in the phone as well, to sort of boost certain characteristics of the sound in a way that makes people think that they're having a better time listening to it. Is that right, or have I just made that up?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, that's always happened a bit. Like, a hi-fi is not normally a pure natural sound. There's normally a bit of hyping going on.
Mm.
That could be as subtle as boosting the bass, but also like a bit of harmonic distortion just to thicken the sound up a bit. Mm. But a lot of that actually happens on the audio engineering end. The loudness wars were a famous example where there's a sort of arms race to make stuff sound louder and more exciting.
Yeah. And that was in the sort of late noughties, is that right? Was it earlier?
Yeah. I think it was a noughties thing.
When sort of, you know, drum and bass and EDM were first sort of...
Well, even normal pop albums, if you look at the waveform of standard pop music, it used to be very dynamic and you know, lots of peaks and stuff like that. Whilst it, for a while, it became just a sort of solid bar.
Right.
Because it was just, you know, the energy level was really consistent. So you lose a whole lot of detail, but it does sound impactful. Andrew Sheps was the engineer behind this. So he once said, the Loudness War didn't end. I won it. So he did the notorious like Metallica albums and stuff like that. That everyone said, yeah, that's the line's been crossed.
Well, the funny thing is, the best Metallica album is the one that they did live with the orchestra, the San Francisco
S&M.
And it sounds the best. It sounds by far of all the Metallica albums, because it has depth and richness and.
Yeah, and also captured in one take with a whole load of like really good musicians behind and really good arrangements, and there's probably a lesson in there, isn't there?
There is, yeah. I think there probably is. I suppose the person that we haven't spoken about is a hero of mine, and I think a hero of yours, possibly. Maybe you can deny that if you like. It's Stephen Wilson, who
he's a hero. Yeah.
I mean, I've been listening to him since I was about 15. And he was about 48. so at that point,
he looked 15.
But for those who don't know him, I mean, he's an absolutely incredible. I think he's the best living British musician, artist, whatever you want to call him, alive today. He's sort of famous as the archetypal cult British musician, isn't he? He does.
Yeah.
You know, that is his niche. But he's been making. He's an incredible audio engineer and producer, and I think he is acknowledged, isn't he, as a sort of world class practitioner.
Whilst taking he's great because he uses the cutting edge of modern techniques when they're useful, but also really respects the old fashioned methods. And so, some of his albums are recorded, you know, the whole band in a live room in air studios, like the old fashioned way. And it sounds great. But also his more recent stuff, he'll use the tools to create the effect he wants. And he's a master of it.
Yeah. So, whenever I want, these days, whenever I want to listen to something that is going to really give me an incredible experience, just a kind of a sonic experience that's incredible with depth and sort of that mastery of craft that really draws you into a track, I'll listen to something from Stephen Wilson. I mean, particularly from his last two albums, Harmony Codex and The Future Bites.
They're albums you sit down and listen to in their entirety, which is quite a rare thing these days. Like, if I want to listen to a whole album, I'll either be going back to something from the 80s or him, really.
Yeah. I was actually listening to a track or two before we started our conversation and before we started recording, just to kind of get in the zone for audio production. And on his most recent one, Harmony Codex, there's a bit, I think it's on the track Time Is Running Out, where it just starts with this incredibly low kind of bass sound that sounds like distant thunder, but it's unbelievably deep and ominous. And just listening to that sound gives me that feeling of, you know, chills or, you know, hairs raised on the back of my neck. And it's just a single sound that he's produced. But it has such unbelievable presence on the track, this sound. You're like, wow. Just listen to that, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, anybody thinks that, oh, this is just some idiot waxing lyrical about some bloke he likes. You know, actually, it is genuinely very, very good. It is a cut above anything else you'll hear.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard him talking a lot about how much he loves ambient music, whether it's Baron Eno or like Tangerine Dream and stuff. He draws influence from the whole spectrum of music, including the really weird stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he's got amazing use of sort of traditional sort of plain song and chanting on a lot of his tracks as well, and just amazing. Anyway, I think the thing about Stephen Wilson's thing is that, you know, you were saying that you don't want it to be too perfect because you lose the personality of the band or the artist. I think that I've understood you correctly in that, right? I'm not misquoting you. Well, I think that with Stephen Wilson's stuff, I mean, it is perfect, isn't it? It is produced, it is perfect what he produces, but it's almost like that is his personality. His personality is obsessive perfection in his musicianship. So I guess it kind of...
I mean, well, when we say we want the personality of the band to shine through, I mean, that doesn't have to be... Yeah, the band's a bit... but they're, you know, having a good time.
Miss a note. Yeah. Or miss a beat occasionally.
We're allowed to have excellent performers performing excellently because they can do stuff with their instruments that other people can't. And if you're going to do that, then that needs to be captured faithfully. And actually, modern music is quite rare. One of the things I like about Stephen Wilson is he gets really good musicians in the room and just lets them loose, because what a studio musician is doing mostly at the moment is very boring for them, I think. And so if you if you get them in to do, okay, we're going to do a 6-minute instrumental section, just feel it.
Yeah.
I mean, regret number nine. I only discovered the other day that solo wasn't written, and he released an alternate take of it the other day.
Yeah,
and it's completely different. Yeah. It's just a completely different song.
Oh, well, I mean, when we've been seeing him live, he just has this backing band of sort of, they look like wizards who've put sort of black t-shirts on. Don't they? They have like long grey hair and a ponytail, about 72, sort of chain smoking his whole life. And they just kind of get behind the keyboard or get behind the bass or whatever, and they just close their eyes and you're off.
We say that, and then you read their biographies. And like, I mean, the guy playing keys when we saw him, he was Miles Davis's musical director.
Is he really? That doesn't surprise me.
And he's just some wizard in the back.
Yeah, incredible. Well, anyway, I mean, this whole podcast episode just ends up as a plug for Stephen Wilson. That's fine with me. Go and listen to it.
He's great.
He's amazing. Okay, so I suppose that this it segues it, or it could segue into the sort of questions of perception that I think are very interesting. It opens up a way of thinking about the philosophy and the mechanics of human perception. I was reading something very, very interesting the other day about vision, which was basically saying that most of the information travel that goes through the optic nerve is not coming from the eyes to the brain, but going the other way around. The reason for that is that you see what you expect to see and correct with the incoming data. So you'll turn around, I'll look at my laptop and my brain will have this is the theory, my brain will have a model of what it expects to see, the way from the sort of the geometric form to the color to your face being projected on it. And I'm looking skeptical and worried about the direction of the podcast and so forth and so on. And then what will happen is that my eyes will... What my eyes are doing is they're just simply checking that expected image is correct against the sense data that my eyes can detect.
But isn't that a theory for like how the entire brain works?
Yes.
What's it called? Predictive processing or something like that, where you're constantly comparing a model to reality.
Yes.
And whenever there's a difference, you flag it up and pay attention to that.
Yeah, exactly.
But if reality is matching the model near enough, you're just going to go with the model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason, the theory goes that the reason this works is because it's incredibly efficient. Instead of having to build build your sensorium from scratch, or build your experience from scratch, microsecond by microsecond, from the raw data, instead you just run your prior model, which is presumably cheaper, sort of neurologically, and just verify it, and that verification process is only really going to be costing you energy when there's an anomaly, because that's when you then have to pay attention and rebuild from scratch. So it's an incredibly efficient way to run it.
But has downsides, because obviously a child's experience is far more vivid because everything's coming for the first time, whilst now we're just coasting on models and everything's kind of as expected. And that's why people get boring as they get older.
Yes. I wonder whether there's, how this relates to this business of audio engineering and audio production. Let me kind of spray out a few thoughts. So one thought would be everything is more real and vivid and memorable when you're a teenager, right? Because being a teenager in a sense is like a second childhood, because you suddenly you've got a whole load of new objectives, should we say, in the world. And that means that you have to see the world in a new way. So I think that you go through a kind of a second milder stage of that vividness. Think of a good... My words are failing me today.
Vividity.
Yes.
Vivacity.
Vivacity, yeah. You get a sort of a second flush of that. And I think that's, one of the reasons why stuff that happens to you when you're a teenager is so foundational to your kind of, your mental life. And obviously the music that you listen to when you're a teenager is as almost everybody knows, it becomes this incredibly... personal thing to you. And you teenagers obsess over music, they identify themselves with it, and it becomes almost like they want to inhabit it physically. I certainly did. And it becomes a very emotionally charged thing, the music you listen to then. And whereas, you know, when you're in your 30s, should we say, I'm sort of sitting there thinking, gosh, this audio production on Stephen Wilson is incredible. It's giving me chills. I'm no longer sitting there, you know, thinking like, oh my God, you know, Kurt Cobain really gets me. This is incredible. or if I do, it's because I thought that when I was a teenager, and I sort of have an echo of that feeling when I listen to it. It wouldn't actually be Kurt Cobain for getting the idea.
Yeah. It'd probably still be Stephen Wilson.
Yeah, I just started listening to him when I was about 14, 15. Introduced by my dad, so pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be my counter example is that you introduced me to Stephen Wilson in my mid to late 20s, I think. and yet, yeah, he's important.
Yeah. And okay, so I mean, that's one thought that we could talk about. I mean, another thought would be: are we robbing ourselves of an aspect of possible musical experience and enjoyment by conforming to this, you know, very optimized sound that is the standard thing that's produced by engineers and producers like yourself? Or, you know, if we were, I don't know, more creative or willing to break the rules or be uncomfortable when we listen to things, would we ultimately have a richer experience? Like a teenager.
Yeah, although the experimental music's normally bollocks.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I'm not prejudging the answer to this question at all.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think we saw with television that the switch to streaming unleashed a lot of creativity, because no longer did you have to create television episodes in a certain format to be played at a certain time with adverts at certain moments to fit in a certain slot in the schedule. Mm. You know, you could just, you know, do what felt justified. And I think that's why something like Breaking Bad felt so vivid, was because if the episode only needed to be 25 minutes long, it'd be 25 minutes long. If it needed an hour, it'd be an hour. And they could explore a really wide range of tonality. You could have a whole episode about, you know, Walter White chasing a fly around the room.
That's the one everyone, which, you know, that's the one everyone talks about, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, because it's so out there. I mean, can you imagine, you know, a 1980s television show just doing that at 7 PM on BBC Two on a Friday? Like, it's unthinkable.
People would be a bit confused, wouldn't they?
Yeah. But music doesn't seem to have done that. In many ways, it's gone the other way. It's got even more generic, because now, you know, people used to buy albums, and an album is actually a space in which an artist could experiment and express themselves. You know, you basically had, you know, an hour of tape. you know, do what you want. Well, it's now really you need something that's going to be listened to on Spotify. And also, I mean, the whole question about, well, is there any point in creating art if no one's going to listen to it? And I think Stephen Wilson's said about this, well, you know, if no one listens to it, it's just masturbation. Like, if you want to, you know, say something, you need someone to listen.
Yeah.
And so you need to make stuff that gets heard, but to get heard on Spotify, like, for example, long introductions. Because so it's something the band's been wrestling with, is, well, how do we put an album up on Spotify and have people actually listen to it? And one of the big things is that you need to get to the meat of your song within 20 seconds, otherwise people are going to stop listening.
I mean, I'd say I'm pretty towards the end of the bell curve in terms of my tolerance for progressive kind of stuff in music and different forms and so forth. But even I'm guilty of when a Pink Floyd track comes on and there's a sort of a 5-minute silent intro, you're kind of like, oh, for Christ. You know, skip it to something else. But I wonder whether... Of course,
but I've been having to like delete the first 30 seconds of every track we've been doing.
I think that there's an interesting point here, which is that obviously Netflix is dealing ultimately with narratives that are appealing to the kind of narrative semantic faculties in our minds, and that they're entertained that way. But of course, music is not about narrative. While, you know, the likes of Stephen Wilson and King Crimson and Pink Floyd may well insert a narrative into their album, it's not really what it's about. I mean, even Daft Punk, you know, they obviously famously didn't they make a sort of an opera? It was a concept album, wasn't it? The 2000, oh, whatever it was. Well, anyway, you know, bands will put narratives out there through their albums, but the album's quality is not a product of the narrative. The narrative is almost this kind of gimmick.
That's
on top, really.
For the true fans, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, actually music is appealing to, well, what is it appealing to? I mean, that is a fascinating question when we think about, I mean, it's a classic question, isn't it? Why do we like music? Yeah, what's it doing? What purpose is it serving from any sort of reductionist perspective, whether it's evolutionary, materialist, you know, whatever. What purpose is it serving? Why do we like it?
Yeah.
But so you can absolutely do a 10-hour Netflix extravaganza with, you know, 10-hour-long episodes, because you can hook people in with a narrative and that hooks people, and we know that. And we,
yeah, they always know what happens next.
There are lots of reasons why that's the case with human beings. And they're very interesting, but you know, with music, you are looking for that immediacy of sensation that great music gives you, which is quite a different type of enjoyment from the more slow burn, cerebral enjoyment of inhabiting a narrative. It's much more like it's a physical sensation, the enjoyment of listening to music, rather than an intellectual
Yeah, it's going to lizard brain, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what's your give me a narrative for why we like music.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously a fascinating question. I suppose that I would start to hypothesize around the idea that we are ourselves islands of organized complexity in a kind of sea of entropy. I mean, that's kind of what life is. It's localized sophistication and complexity and order in a context of ever-increasing entropy, according to the second law of thermodynamics. And how is that able to be produced? Well, it's because there's an incredible amount of thermodynamic energy that comes off the sun, and that can, it means you've got a huge, huge bank of credit of energy, and which means that you can defy the second law of thermodynamics, in a sense, in a local area on the surface of the planet where this energy hits. So in a sense, we're just frittering off the excess entropy of the sun. And that's what life is. So when you think of life that way, and as a sort of a localized bit of organized complexity, pattern, in other words, even if it's an incredibly complex, shifting series of patterns, it's ultimately about patterns. Then you can start to think about, well, okay, patterns can always be expressed mathematically, and music, as we know, is a sort of a representation of mathematical patterns in matter and energy and so forth.
Well, you got three patterns the price of one. You've got melody, you've got harmony, and you've got rhythm. So yeah, you're getting a triple dose.
Yeah, so I would start to feel towards an answer this way and say that actually something quite incredible is going on, which is something along the lines of when we're enjoying good music, we are, you know, in a sense, mainlining what life is in its most fundamental sense.
Okay, you put it better than just like getting high off patterns. But
yeah.
but pattern.
Yeah, ooh, I love a pattern. Yeah, exactly. we are in a real sense kind of really tapping into the essence of what we are.
Yeah. Okay.
And so you would expect it to have a very remarkable physiological effect on you, because, you know, our physiology is very, very complex patterns. And presumably, you know, you can then start to feel towards, well, okay, so why does one thing sound good? Why does one particular progression of chords or whatever sound good and another thing not sound good? Well, you know, it may be the case that there are certain, let's say, patterns that are ultimately, the order that they represent is in some way analogous to something that is highly adaptive. Now, I have no idea how that relationship is formed or what that would actually look like in practice, but you can at least imagine a hypothesis that says that, well, you know, in its most fundamental form, the patterns that keep you alive are more like A, B, D, E, G than they are like, you know, G, F, G, G, G. and so we respond to the former but not to the latter. Now, I have no idea whether that...
Yeah, I mean, I can build on that and try and bring it back to the predictive processing where, I mean, the music I find most satisfying is music that has some kind of dissonance then gets resolved.
Mm.
And that resolution is almost like the world returning to the model. So for a minute, like, the music's surprised your brain. It's gone out of pattern.
Mm.
And so you're actually suddenly experiencing that really vividly because your brain's trying to work out what's wrong with the model to make it fit. And then suddenly it goes back, you know, it resolves, it goes back to, you know, a standard chord or a standard rhythm. And your brain's, enough, it's the model. And then you get that sense of relief.
Yeah. You're exactly right. Yeah. So I suppose that on that model, it is hijacking the way that our perception works and stimulating it in a way that it's particularly vulnerable to being stimulated, rather than my kind of deeper layer of sort of existential, you know, real sort of metaphysical meaning. You could say, well, actually, no, what's going on here is that the predictive processing model is obviously is all working on pattern. It's looking for patterns. It's checking patterns that it is holding in its sort of, you know, visual sort of imagination space. It's checking those against the patterns that are outside. And it wants the two to match up, and it likes it when things match up and are harmonious, and it doesn't like it when they're not. And so if you kind of simplify pattern down into something that's actually very pure, because it's only really coming in through one sense, you know, sternum thumping at a sort of massive drum and bass kind of, you know, concert aside, then you can give a really pure, you can manipulate those pleasure, pain, reward systems that are associated with that predictive processing model very effectively with that one single sort of part of the sensorium. What do you think of that?
No, I like it a lot. Do you think that also explains why, like, pounding drums get your blood up and want you to, like, go to war and it arouses the passions? Because that's got to be a dynamic as well, that sort of almost trance state you get into with repetitive rhythms and pounding drums.
Yeah, the trance state. I wonder whether it's sort of, again, hijacked, say, a part of your you know, mental apparatus that is... It almost like it fills it, so it can't do anything else, and so you get into that trance state. You know, the bit of your mind that might otherwise be occupied with worrying about, you know, what Jimmy's going to do tomorrow, or, you know, whether there's a tiger behind the tree, sort of gets occupied through this sort of hypnotic repetition of a different part of the sensorium, and so you go into a trance. Could you explain? I'm very sympathetic to the idea that this could be, that you could explain drums and getting your blood pumping and all of that, you know, using this type of explanation. But could you explain sort of, or start to talk about how you think that would be working? You know, I'm imagining the sort of the snare drums in a sort of Napoleonic regiment you know, that kind of thing. Like, what do you think that's all about?
War drums. I mean, I am a drummer, and so this always high on my mind, because all this kind of complexity and patterns and, you know, resolutions and stuff applies to everyone else in the band, but not to me. I'm just going dun 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 for an hour.
Yeah.
But I somehow still find it satisfying and rewarding.
Yeah.
It's hard to know why. I mean, I'd heard one theory that... especially a lot of folk music, if you go to Bulgaria or Turkey, it ends up being a dun, 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 dun. And there's one theory I heard, I don't know how crackpot it is, that the ongoing rhythm is in sync with your brain waves or something like that.
Mm.
And so that, therefore, trance state.
Well, you can imagine that, because, imagine that the neural correlate of consciousness, right? This is the phrase that philosophers of consciousness use. The neural correlate of consciousness is basically whatever is physically happening in the body or in the brain, that directly results in a conscious experience with content, right? That's called the NCC, the neural correlate of consciousness. Now, presumably, that neural correlate of consciousness is going to be very much plugged into the rest of the sensorium and the senses and, you know, incoming data and all of that kind of thing, because otherwise it would be just free-floating and contentless. Now, if you have an overwhelming sensory input that's extremely repetitive, then that will start to force whatever the neural correlate of consciousness is to start responding in that rhythm, because it will presumably respond with some kind of electrical pattern or, you know, series of firings or, you know, whatever in response to a particular beat, because how else would it produce the conscious experience of that beat? And so if you do it really repetitively again and again and again and almost drown everything else out, then presumably it does get into a...
It just overpowers everything else.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then I think, crucially, it's happening at the same time to everyone who's listening to it. Mm. And so, in a very real sense, you're on the same wavelength as everyone you're with.
Yeah, far out, man.
Dude.
Wavelength. I think that's plausible, isn't it? I think that works.
Yeah, which is why, you know, it's good to use in war, because it gets the whole team fired up in the same way.
Yeah, or a cynic would say it stops you thinking about, oh shit, like, am I going to get killed? You don't have the sort of the neural real estate free to literally think the thought. I guess that's one way.
That also works. Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, I think we ought to do... I find that very interesting. I think we've made some progress there. I find that... I mean, I've convinced myself that that's something that's interesting and plausible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, nothing to do with audio engineering, but...
Well, I don't know. I mean, because presumably...
Or if you know these patterns are there, that's what you're aiming for, then you want to be trying to do that more?
Well, I suppose that you want to be trying to convey the patterns in their maximal state of intricacy. Right?
Mm.
Because it's going to have the most effect when we're thinking, okay, let's take it as an assumption that we agree or we're willing to assume that it's the pattern that's having the impact upon our mental state through whatever mechanism that might be. Then presumably the job of the audio engineer in its most fundamental sense is to make the pattern communicated with maximum intricacy and sophistication.
And minimum extraneous noise.
Yeah, minimum interference, so that you can get the sort of the fullest possible hit of that particular pattern. And so that would make it sense for why we like separation, a sense of separation between the various instruments, and we like to be able to hear each individual thing, but also hear them at the same time, so that you get that whole picture. Whereas if you just get the kind of the sludge in one band. One sort of audio band, then that's less satisfying.
Yeah, because it's hidden partly. And
it's not in its maximal unfolded intricacy.
Yeah, I like that. So audio engineering, as much as anything to do with music, is an expression of a theory of mind.
Very good. Well done, sir. Very good place.
to a good
summarizing thought. I think that we ought to do... leading on from this, maybe we should do one. I do think that we should do one on the philosophy of consciousness. We should have a discussion about the philosophy of consciousness, because I do a lot of reading about this at the moment.
You'll be leading that one.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I don't know. What do you think? What do you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. Let's pencil that one in for a couple of months, and I can do some.
Build up to it.
I've
got some thoughts. There's a blog called Mind Coolness that inspired me on this, so I'll go back to that.
Send me a link.
Yeah.
And there's a book called that you might need to read before we do it, which is called The Feeling of Life Itself by Christoph Koch. You'll like it.
Amazon.
You'll like it, I promise.
Amazon.
He's German and very clear. He has a he has a tattoo of a neuron on his bicep.
Nice.
Yeah. This is the kind of man we're dealing with. So, strongly recommend.
Yeah, and that will also help me with my audio product. I've been doing this all wrong. I've been watching like 10-hour YouTube tutorials on how to use compression and EQ and reverb.
Yeah, doing it all wrong.
What I should have been doing is reading neuroscience.
Well, that's what you've been doing is upping your technair, which is your sort of craft. But
technique is freedom. Yeah, you need these tools to be able to then express the theory.
Yeah, exactly. But now Thank that you. You've nailed your technair, now you can move towards, you know, Sophia, wisdom. which is the explanation for why technair works, as Aristotle pointed out. So there we go. Yeah, we can leave the listeners with that thought, I think.
Yeah, that's actually quite satisfying.
Very good.
Actually, while I've got you, I thought I'd take the opportunity to talk you through how I'm engineering this podcast. It's an eccentric setup because it's all stuff I purchased and techniques I learned for recording music, specifically drums, and more generally, four-piece rock bands, but not for podcasts. First, the microphone. Controversially, I'm speaking into an AKG D112. Why controversial? It's a kick drum microphone. I had tried all my other microphones and they sounded terrible with my voice, so here we are. Actually, the D112 is an evolution of the D12, which was designed as a vocal mic, but turned out to be really good for kick drums. So this isn't too unexpected that it sounds good on a voice. This goes into a Focusrite Scarlett 8i6 third generation audio interface, which is pretty standard. This is the box that takes the microphone signal and gets into my laptop, which is a Lenovo ThinkPad, since you ask. I record using Ableton, the digital audio workstation. It's normally used for electronic music, but it's pretty good all round and very easy to use. Then, within that, I have a bunch of plugins, which are small software modules that change the sounds I've recorded and emulate the racks and racks of gear you see in an old-fashioned recording studio. So on my vocal channel, I start with Silk Vocal, which is a multiband compressor that reduces the harshness of my voice and de-esses the recording, which means it reduces the volume of the S's and the T's, which come across way too strongly in any vocal recording. It also adds some heavy compression, which reduces the amplitude peaks and effectively makes the quiet stuff louder. And this means that the listening experience is a lot more consistent and feels a bit louder and punchier. And it's into another plugin called the Sheps Omnichannel 2, which is a general-purpose channel strip developed by legendary engineer Andrew Sheps. So this is basically all the knobs that you see above the fader on an old-fashioned recording desk. I have this adding saturation through a preamp module, and this makes my voice sound a bit richer. Then some EQ, boosting the low mids a bit, and adding some higher frequencies. And this is all to kind of shape and flatten my voice a bit. And this also adds a bit more compression. The best way of doing compression is to add small amounts in several phases. Finally, there's a gate which turns off my microphone signal when the volume goes below a certain threshold, so you don't hear me breathing heavily and drinking whiskey when my co-host is speaking. Then I bring this and the other channels together into what's called a master bus, which is a kind of final output channel. And to this, I add some more plugins to glue everything together and deliver the audio at broadcast-friendly levels. So first, an SSL compressor emulation, which is more compression. Then something called IM Pusher, which is a mastering plugin developed by Infected Mushroom. And this adds a bit more compression, a bit more saturation, a bit more EQ, and a limiter to catch the highest peaks. And so this is trying to turn the kind of raw recordings into something a bit more polished. We then go through another limiter, the Waves L2 Ultra Maximizer, which again cuts off the peaks so that nothing pokes through or breaches any thresholds when you listen to it on Spotify. Then it goes to a loudness meter, so I know I've got the right loudness levels for Spotify or whatever. That will do for now. But this is intended to illustrate that you can't just speak into a microphone and expect it to sound good. And even if you are doing that, there'll be some software on your computer that's working very hard to up your game. Thank you for listening.